The views and opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of WEFT-FM, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the Weft Associates. And now here is this week's edition of IMC Radio News.
Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
This week on IMC Radio News, a report on police brutality in the Champaign-Urbana area and efforts to prevent it, and a report from Auntie B's Knees on the other side of business news. Stay tuned. Ariel Clemenzi brings us the following report on police brutality in our community and efforts to prevent it.
October 22nd marked the 8th annual National Day of Protest against police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. The October 22nd coalition that initiated this day of protest in 1996 was formed by the collective efforts of PAM Africa, of the group MOVE, Akil Al-Jundi of the Community Self-Defense Program, Angel Cervantes of the Four Winds Student Movement, Omowale Clay of the December 12th Movement, Carl Dix of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. Many major metropolitan areas held street demonstrations and vigils in honor of October 22nd, including the city of Chicago, which had a protest staged by the local chapter of Refuse and Resist. I took the opportunity to talk with people in the Champaign-Urbana community about their experiences with and their thoughts on police brutality and what can be done to stop it.
I've been drugged in the streets by our police department. I've been whipped by batons. I've been handcuffed to cells and all of that. I've never been shot at by them. And I've had foul language directed towards me and all of that.
John Lee Johnson is a local community activist and economic developer. He has been active in Champaign-Urbana and a leader in the black community since the 1950s. He told me that the experiences with brutality that he just described happened in Champaign in the 1960s and 70s. I asked him how police brutality in this community has changed and what it looks like now.
There have been now sporadic incidents where people in our community have lost their lives when they've come in contact with the Champaign Police Department, more so than in the Urbana Police Department. But there still remains a kind of better sophistication in brutality in our communities. Brutality now is in the form of a police officer comes to a wreck and it involves people of color and a non-person of color, and he doesn't issue a ticket even though the person of color was not at fault. Those kinds of things. You know, of course, profiling of African-American people is a form of unnecessary brutality. The use of computers to systematically profile everyone through the informational system, as well as that there are still many incidents of unnecessary force at the actual door of people of color by the Champaign Police Department. And you don't hear that many complaints about the Urbana Police Department, but there are complaints that that kind of heavy-handed police operation occurs over even there.
Mr. Johnson also shared some of his thoughts on why police brutality continues to be a problem, both locally and nationally.
You got to remember that police departments are culture within themselves. And a part of that is that you believe that there is no one greater than you on the street. And that is an attitude that you must have, they believe, in order to withstand what you see on the street and the forces that may be brought against you and your willingness to bring greater force against that force which is against you. If you felt that these people are just as human as you are and you realize that you're carrying the means to destroy them, then there's a possibility that you may not be willing to use those means. So it was not unusual to find that the discussions that went on privately among police officers, that it was them against us. And it's far better that we get destroyed than they can go home than that we destroy them and they can't go home. So even though changes occurred, the changes did not necessarily occur in the culture of the police department. And that is still a problem today in our nation, simply because many of the old guard still manages our police department. And although there are some attempts on the part of police academies to change the attitude and to bring about a more enlightened process requiring police officers to have, you know, 2-year or 4-year degrees, which was not required. Now, as you know, here in the city of Champaign, Champaign is doing a pre-test psychological evaluation and an after-hire psychological evaluation, because it has taken all these years in the creation and the existence of the police in our community for people to realize that police officers can be as crazy as citizens, and that you have to really question why a person wants to be a police officer, just as you have to question why a person wants to be a career soldier, and particularly a soldier that is a combatant soldier. Why do you want to do that? Because it involves taking of human life and destroying a property. So why do you want to be a police officer when it can involve taking of human life and destruction of property and the power that gives one? You know, why do you want to do that? Are you capable of handling that? You know, and then when you're isolated from the Pacific community that you police and from the greater community, what kinds of psychological impacts are there, and what kinds of support systems are you surrounded with? You know, which is why there's a high rate of alcoholism, drug use, divorces among America's police department. Police departments are isolated from the community as a whole. Even when they're monitored by themselves in the main and not necessarily by an impartial citizen review committee. The government believes that it is a central arm of its service, and therefore it is very protective of their police department, which is why police departments are allowed and have been allowed to get away with so much violation of people's civil rights. And in the main, it has always been the violation of the people's rights of color, or the violation of progressive white Americans who have been subject to the abuse of the police department. It has only become recent that police have taken on the whole concept of police-community relationships. Even though we have that here, we still don't have it in the purest sense, because police departments do not challenge the institutions which are suppressing the people that they're policing. They don't challenge the school district because of the literacy rates that they see in the streets. They don't challenge the government because the improper and the poor condition of housing that the government operates and provides for the people. They don't challenge them because of the poor health system, all contributing to the unrest that they must oversee and police. And too many police officers have taken it as a part of the unnecessary responsibility and their duty to police this, not really understanding that what they see is an extension of them and an extension of their activities, because they have allowed the state, by dividing the protection between the activities of the state and the masses of people in which the state is affecting, they have guarded the state and therefore prevented the people from seeking redress and from changing the very policies that have kept them poor.
Next, I spoke with attorney Harvey C. Welch, an Urbana-based criminal defense attorney, about what types of police abuse are common in this area.
I believe stops are abused, that they just make up or conjure up reasons to stop. I believe the frisk issues are abused. I believe that motor vehicle stops are almost done almost like in a racial or drug type profiling. As I said, the brutality or excessive use of force here is most of the time, as I say, that pushing and shoving, handcuffing, a little bit of rough treatment. You know, I don't hear many cases about, you know, people being billy clubbed and things like that. But just the reports you read, in my opinion, give abuse of the power to stop. and detain and investigate. And I think that's very selectively turned on targets. When they don't find anything, you know, these citizens feel so grateful that the encounter is over. You don't hear about a lot of that. And then we defense lawyers are left going to court arguing to judges that the police have overstepped their bounds. And in every one of these cases, you know, there's some contraband that's been found or we wouldn't all be there. And that tends to, I think, influence the judge's thinking on the favor or the side of the police. And it's our job as defense attorneys to keep reminding them that it's the process that that the judge should be focusing on. What is eventually found should be immaterial.
Attorney Welch went on to discuss the balance between the responsibilities of police and the rights of citizens.
I do not believe that the police have any rights. I believe they've been given certain authority, but I always, whenever I listen to speakers discuss this, I always listen very carefully to their use of language. And I just cringe when I hear people say the police have the right. Now, that may be a slip of the tongue, and they don't really mean it like a constitutional right. But even that, I would object to. I don't think the police have any rights. They have authority that they've been given, and it's very limited. But citizens have rights. Police don't. And I think we've lost some of that balance. You know, you hear speaker, we need to give the police more rights to do this, more rights to do that. No, we need to give the police less rights and restrain them. Because there are police, for example, who believe that during these stops for temporary questioning, that they have a right to frisk an individual. Because they say under the Terry decision, stop and frisk, very famous Supreme Court decision that opened this whole box back in 1968, that they then think they have the right to frisk people. And many times that's what they're really trying to do. The whole stop is a pretext. They're just hoping to be able to put their hands on somebody so if they can feel something, then the supposed reason, you know, for ID purposes is gone. Now you're carrying a weapon. And so what I believe to be the correct interpretation of that Terry decision is you may have a reason to stop somebody or detain them temporarily for questioning. But unless you believe, and it has to be a reasonable belief. Some of these guys just have a knee-jerk belief. And you read in their police reports, they'll stop somebody for an ordinary, like, traffic violation. The person will get out of the car and they say, I searched the person for my own safety. Well, that's wrong. Because you have to be able to articulate a reason why you believe your safety may be at issue. But so many of them and so many judges then also just race right by that and say, if they had a reason to stop, then they have a reason to frisk.
One of Mr. Welch's clients, a local peace and human rights activist named Lori, explains her encounter with the Champaign police at a peace protest on Prospect Avenue. Lori and one of the pro-war protesters got into an altercation.
Next thing I see is all these angry pro-war people in front of me yelling at me, waving their flags. I mean, they're coming at me with flagstaffs. I thought I was going to get lynched, and I get hit from behind by like a 300-pound force with a knee to the back, and my face is in the dirt, completely in the dirt. I can't even see. My glasses are jerked up my face. And this man's screaming at me, give me your left arm, give me your left arm, give me your left arm. Never identifying himself as a police officer. There were no police officers in visible sight around me. All I heard was screaming. I heard people saying, don't hurt her. My left arm was pinned underneath my body, so I wasn't able to produce my left arm immediately. I calmly tried to say, I'm on top of my left arm. I need to get up to give you my left arm. I had no idea who this was. I mean, it could be a pro-war guy who had handcuffs on his pickup truck and decided to mess around with us, you know? So finally, when I was able to get up, because this man was on top of me, completely on top of me, knee to the back, when I was finally able to get up, I was sort of lifted up. I gave him my left hand. I was handcuffed. I was raised to my feet and escorted to a police car, made to sit in a police car for 20-some minutes without ever being asked what my side of the story was, why I reacted the way I did. The police gave me resisting a peace officer as a city ordinance violation of a $175 fine. When I asked the officer why he felt the need to tackle me, he said he didn't tackle me. I asked him why he hit me. He said he didn't hit me, but I had felt definitely a blow to the back, whether it was his baton or his knee. I think it was his knee. I have witnesses that say he definitely came running from the parking lot, so several yards, a running start, never facing me, never getting between the woman and me, never identifying himself as a police officer, and basically just tackled me on an emotional rush. And the other two officers that were there backed up his story. And I took this to court, and I fought it in court, and I lost, because a city ordinance violation is like a traffic ticket, and most people don't dispute it. And Judge Ford said that had it been a state charge, like if I had really been arrested, I was just detained in a police car, but if I had been arrested, they would have had to have more than a preponderance of evidence to prove that I violated any laws. And so... He sided with the police officers. The officers had said that I had lost my balance and fell on my own, that they had gently touched my arm and said, police. Their whole story was completely fabricated, and they won in court.
Elaine German is a law student at the U of I and is involved with the Coalition for Citizen Police Review, a grassroots group of concerned local citizens and community organizations who aim to implement a citizen police review board in Urbana and Champaign. The aim of a citizen police review board would be to provide an independent evaluation of citizen complaints about police conduct and examine policies and procedures of the police department to ensure that they genuinely serve the interests of justice for all in the community. While a growing number of cities across the country have successfully taken on similar initiatives, Champaign County still uses the police department itself to investigate citizens' concerns, a situation that many argue discourages citizen input and promotes secrecy. Elaine talked with me about the ways that a citizen police review board can make policing easier for the cops while also protecting the community.
The police want the widest range of discretion possible with the least amount of oversight, which is, on the one hand, it's understandable, but that also tends to decrease the community's trust in the police, and I think that makes policing then harder to do. I think the great thing about a citizen police review board is that ultimately it could increase community's trust in policing and thus making it easier for the police officers to do their job. If we knew that there was a kind of a backup system or a fail-safe system where people could go if the system was breaking down, if there was a police officer who was acting inappropriately, if we knew that there was a system that would take care of that, we would be more trusting of police officers as a whole, I think. There was a case recently in Urbana in the last 6 months in which the city had to pay out over $300,000 for a police brutality case or police misconduct. So I think it's still in appeals, but the point being, ideally you end up saving money, you know, because lawsuits are where cities really get hit hard financially. So it's sort of, again, it's preventative, and our society isn't always good on spending money on prevention, but I think it does end up being much cheaper in the long run.
The civil suit which Elaine referred to involved a man whose neck was broken by Urbana police officer Brian Wilfong in October of 2000. While being placed under arrest, the Urbana man was on his stomach, with his hands cuffed behind his back, when Officer Wilfong put his knee on the man's back and pulled back the man's head, breaking his neck. In March of this year, a jury ruled that the city of Urbana and Officer Wilfong violated the man's 4th and 14th Amendment rights by use of excessive force and denial of due process. For IMC Radio News, this is Ariel Clemenzi.
And here's Auntie Bee's Knees with the other side of your business news.
You U.S. Treasury Secretary John Snow spent most of last weekend panhandling for donations from the G20's other finance ministers. Snow is reported to have held private meetings with officials from Germany, China, Argentina, Russia, Mexico, Turkey, South Africa, and France, urging them to support U.S.-led reconstruction efforts. Snow arrived in Mexico fresh from a rather dismal two-day conference in Madrid, Spain, where he managed to convince only a handful of officials gathered from 77 nations to cough up a total of $13 billion in new aid for Iraq. The money includes $5 billion in grants and loans pledged by Japan, $500 million in new funding from Kuwait, $500 million in loans and an equal amount in export credits from Saudi Arabia, $812 million from the European Union, and $100 million from Canada. Apart from Japan, the largest contributors to U.S.-led reconstruction efforts in Iraq are the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, who will together shell out up to $9 billion over the next 5 years. Snow's campaign to win international support for U.S. occupation and reconstruction in Iraq has been blighted by the Pentagon's mismanagement of reconstruction efforts and by the Bush administration's unilateral approach to foreign policy. A World Bank official recently told the New York Times that European countries in particular are concerned that the U.S.-led Coalition Provision Authority, or CPA, is the sole decision-making power in Iraq. Quote, "For political reasons, they don't want their funds to be perceived as being commingled with funds controlled by the CPA. They want their own say over how money is spent," end quote. Just before the U.S. invaded Iraq, post-war administration efforts were handed to the Pentagon-controlled CPA, rather than the U.S. State Department, which would normally oversee such efforts. Soon after major combat operations ended, it became clear that the Pentagon had based its post-war plans on 1991 Gulf War scenarios. The first head of the reconstruction team, retired U.S. General Jay Garner, led U.S. efforts in northern Iraq in 1991. This time around, Garner stockpiled food, tents, and medical supplies and employed teams of wildcat oil field specialists to cap potential oil well fires. But relatively little was done to prepare for a return to civilian administration in Iraq. Reconstruction priorities were set by U.S. occupying forces rather than Iraqi administrators. Programs to reestablish the legal system and return government ministries to normal operations were kept out of the picture. The training of local police was left up to the Canadian government, who finally volunteered for the job last week. Questions regarding staffing, spending, and opaque decision-making within the CPA eventually led Bush to appoint security advisor Condoleezza Rice as head of an Iraq stabilization group earlier this month. The group is expected to, quote-unquote, crack the whip at officials leading Iraqi reconstruction efforts in Washington and Baghdad. Most of the CPA's efforts in Iraq have been bankrolled by a U.S.-controlled development fund. The fund was created by the UN last May to replace the UN's Oil for Food program. The fund is administered by U.S. officials, and its money is kept in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. All of the former Iraqi government's assets deposited anywhere in the world, and all past and future revenues from the sale of Iraqi oil, are to be turned over to this fund. To pad the fund, U.S. officials plan to auction off most of Iraq's formerly state-owned industries in a massive privatization scheme. The fund is being used not only to pay for reconstruction projects in Iraq, but to allow the U.S. Export and Import Bank to extend credit to U.S. companies hoping to buy out Iraq's nationalized corporations or to start businesses in the war-torn country. About $1 billion worth of assets were transferred to the fund from the Oil for Food program in May, and an additional $5 billion has gone into the fund so far. But according to a report by Christian Aid in the UK, more than $4 billion of this has gone missing. No process exists to monitor how money from the fund is spent, a proposed oversight committee has not been appointed, and no auditing mechanism is in place for the fund. In short, the development fund gives carte blanche to the Pentagon to defend and expand U.S. corporate interests in Iraq. Debate over the Pentagon's management of post-war Iraq has been fueled by further controversy as the Pentagon has awarded lucrative reconstruction contracts to firms with close ties to the Bush administration. USAID regulations require that only U.S. contractors can be hired for projects paid for with U.S. development funds. But even the U.S.-based companies granted contracts in Iraq were selected through secret backroom deals that favored corporations with close connections to the Bush administration. The most controversial contract went to Kellogg Brown & Root, a subsidiary of the Halliburton Oil Services Company that U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney used to work for. In March, Kellogg Brown & Root was awarded an unlimited no-bid contract to repair Iraq's oil infrastructure. Another major contract for rebuilding Iraq's ports, power stations, telephone lines, and water supply was awarded in April to Bechtel, a company with close ties to George Shultz, Secretary of State under George Bush Sr. Needless to say, it has been difficult for companies from outside the U.S. to win contracts for work in Iraq. Iraqi firms themselves have been excluded from the bidding process, marking a significant failure by the CPA to rebuild Iraq's economy by providing economic opportunities for Iraqi business. A third criticism of the reconstruction process is that U.S. contractors are now overcharging the CPA for supplies. Kellogg Brown & Root charges $1.59 per gallon for gasoline imported from Turkey, whereas the going market rate in the Persian Gulf is 76 cents per gallon plus about 25 cents for transport. U.S. contractors and subcontractors are charging far higher rates for construction projects than Iraqi contractors would, as has been discovered through analysis of the Bush administration's proposed $20 billion aid package for Iraq. This $20 billion in so-called aid is part of an $87 billion package for Iraq that provides $65 billion for military occupation. The U.S. Congress cut back the Bush administration's request for reconstruction funds by nearly $1.5 billion to eliminate overpriced items like $50,000 garbage trucks and a $300 million prison. Most of the $20 billion aid package will pay for deals with U.S. companies, making this so-called aid little more than a handout to corporate America. Nonetheless, the U.S. Senate has voted to convert half of the proposed package into a loan, increasing Iraq's burden of foreign debt and forcing Iraqi people to pay for their country being overrun by U.S. corporate interests. Iraq is already the world's largest debtor, owing between $100 and $400 billion to foreign creditors. The country's economy has been crippled by 12 years of U.S.-led, U.N.-sponsored economic sanctions that began and ended with U.S.-led wars. But the U.S. Senate's decision to convert half of the proposed aid package into loans reveals not only the scope of U.S. corporate interests within the U.S. government. The 51-47 vote by the Republican-led Senate also reflects U.S. lawmakers' concerns that Bush is spending vast amounts of taxpayer dollars overseas while racking up record deficits at home, where state governments are unable to provide basic services and unemployment is increasing. The $10 billion loan voted for by the U.S. Senate could be converted back into a grant if France, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and other foreign creditors forgive at least 90% of Iraq's debt. But there appears little chance of this debt being forgiven. U.S. requests for aid from France, Germany, and Russia, who each opposed the U.S. invasion of Iraq, have so far met with an icy response. Saudi Arabia is providing its aid in the form of further loans and export credits, compounding the debt it is owed by Iraq. $3.5 billion of Japan's $5 billion in contributions will be administered as loans. Kuwait has promised a rather generous aid package, but is demanding ongoing war reparations from Iraq for the 1991 war. These reparations could amount to a sum far greater than the aid being granted. In fact, most of the $33 billion raised by the U.S. and its allies so far has been set as loans that will simply saddle Iraq with new debt, worsening its economic woes. And $33 billion is still well below the $56 billion estimate that the World Bank has said it will cost to restore Iraq to pre-1991 Gulf War conditions within 5 years. $33 billion is just a fraction of the $500 billion that the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments has calculated it will cost for non-military reconstruction in Iraq. Overall, the money contributed by international governments to reconstruction efforts in Iraq has fallen far short of what is necessary, mostly because potential donors mistrust U.S. policy in Iraq. To quell such fears, the World Bank and UN have set up a separate fund to manage international contributions for the reconstruction of Iraq. The new fund will only oversee non-U.S. donations, meaning that most reconstruction money remains under U.S. control. But most of the $13 billion raised in Madrid will enter the fund, managed by the World Bank, the UN, and a committee of Iraqis. The new fund is expected to give non-U.S. companies a greater role in the bidding process for reconstruction contracts in Iraq, granting donor countries a crack at multi-billion dollar business opportunities in Iraq. In London 2 weeks ago, an investors' conference entitled Doing Business in Iraq, Kickstarting the Private Sector, attracted representatives from nearly 150 multinational corporations. The companies, mainly from the oil and banking sectors, were invited by the U.S. and British governments to move into Iraq as soon as security is restored. The conference was organized by the U.S.-Iraq Business Alliance, set up by the U.S. Treasury Department in October 2002 to facilitate the U.S.-led corporate takeover of Iraq. The conference closed with reports that McDonald's, among other multinational corporations, could begin operations in Iraq by 2005. Yes, Big Macs may be served up in Iraq as early as next year, but only after Bechtel has switched on the lights, Halliburton has rebuilt the bridges, Research Triangle Institute has trained the bureaucrats, and Motorola has set up the mobile phone network. The next Doing Business in Iraq conference is scheduled for Moscow this December, where corporations from outside the U.S. and U.K. will presumably be offered crumbs from the table of Iraq's occupying forces. The cracking open of Iraq's infrastructure to foreign investment and the privatization of Iraq's formerly state-owned industry comes as no surprise to observers of U.S.-led hyper-capitalist expansion. The realities of post-war reconstruction efforts in Iraq lend further credence to the anti-war movement's claim that this war had nothing to do with weapons or dictators, and everything to do with asserting U.S. and British corporate interests in the Middle East. That's a wrap for this week's Business Report. Signing off, this is Auntie Bee's Knees reminding you to put your money where your mouth is and invest ethically.
That wraps up IMC Radio News for this week. Contributors included Ariel Clemenzi. The coordination of the UCIMC Radio News is funded in part by the funding exchanges Paul Robeson Fund for Independent Media. If you'd like to get involved, you can drop us a line at radio@ucimc.org or call 344-8820 extension 1. No experience is necessary. Take care and see you next week.